from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. When the most powerful woman in the U.S. says the attorney general committed a crime, it means something. Here's House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at a press conference yesterday.
He lied to Congress. He lied to Congress. If anybody else did that, it would be considered a crime. Nobody is above the law, not the president of the United States and not the attorney general.
Meanwhile, House Judiciary Chairman Gerald Nadler is threatening to hold Barr in contempt of Congress for defying a subpoena to provide the unredacted Mueller report. Barr also skipped the Judiciary Committee's hearing yesterday on the special counsel's report. We'll look at how this escalation of tensions between House Democrats and the Attorney General is playing out. And joining me is Rory Little. He's a professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, a professor of constitutional law, and a former federal prosecutor. Good morning, Rory Little.
Good morning. Thank you.
Thanks for being here. We also have Andrew Desiderio with us. He's a congressional reporter for Politico. Good morning, Andrew Desiderio.
Hi, good morning.
I want to start with you, Andrew. I am struck by hearing House Speaker Nancy Pelosi say outright that Attorney General Barr lied to Congress and that if anyone else did that, it would be considered a crime, just because she has been so careful in her language around crimes and impeaching President Trump, for example. So what do you think she is doing here? What is she signaling here?
Right. So I think what she's referring to is the fact that the Attorney General previously told a House Appropriations subcommittee a few weeks ago that he was not aware of any concerns among members of Mueller's team about the Attorney General's four-page summary of the Mueller report. We, of course, found out a few days ago that Barr was not only aware of concerns, but he was aware of those concerns directly from Special Counsel Mueller himself, who wrote a letter and had a phone call with the Attorney General to express that he didn't feel that his four-page summary accurately reflected sort of the substance of the investigation and undermined public confidence in the investigation. So that's what the speaker was referring to there. The Attorney General has been saying essentially that he was answering a separate question about whether members of Mueller's team had expressed those concerns directly to him versus Special Counsel Mueller expressing those concerns directly to him. So it's a little bit of hair splitting right there, but Democrats have pretty much rallied around this idea that they believe that the Attorney General committed perjury.
And do you think, though, that they are also becoming more aggressive, changing tactics a little bit here?
I don't think they're changing their tactics. They are certainly becoming more aggressive. I think over the last couple of days, they've used Attorney General Barr as sort of a cudgel in order to channel their anger and their frustration with the fact that the Trump administration has not been complying with their myriad requests for information, witness testimony, documents, and of course those subpoenas that they issued. You mentioned the Wednesday deadline for the subpoena for the full unredacted Mueller report and all of the underlying evidence and grand jury information. The Justice Department said it would not comply with that subpoena, and the committee is now getting ready to hold Barr in contempt. So they're really channeling their anger directly at the Attorney General right now.
On this question of whether or not Attorney General Barr lied to Congress, Rory Little, is there a strong case that Barr committed perjury? And before you answer that, I do want to play the exchanges that seem like they're in question right now. It actually feels like there are two here. I'm going to start with the first one, which is actually an exchange between Barr and Representative Charlie Crist of Florida on April 9th during a House Appropriations Committee hearing.
Reports have emerged recently, General, that members of the special counsel's team are frustrated at some level with the limited information included in your March 24th letter, that it does not adequately or accurately necessarily portray the report's findings. Do you know what they're referencing with that?
No, I don't.
Here's the second exchange that has been mentioned, and this is Chris Van Hollen, Democrat of Maryland, questioning Barr on April 10th.
Mr. Attorney General, the thing is, you put this out there. I mean, the president went out and tweeted the next day that he was exonerated. That wasn't based on anything in the Mueller report with respect to obstruction of justice. That was based on your assessment. That was on March 24th. And now you won't elaborate at all as to how you reached that conclusion. Because I'm not asking you what's in the Mueller report. I'm asking about your conclusion. Let me ask you this.
It was the conclusion of a number of people, including me, and I obviously am the Attorney General.
It was also the conclusion of the Deputy Attorney General, Rod Rosenstein.
I understand. No, I've read
well
your letters,
others, and I will discuss that decision after
did,
the report.
Did Bob Mueller support your conclusion?
I don't know whether Bob Mueller supported my conclusion.
That was Senator Chris Van Hollen, and he has since called for Barr's resignation after learning more about the exchange and about the Mueller letter that was sent to Attorney General Barr on March 27th with concerns about the initial four-page summary that the Attorney General put out. So having listened to those two exchanges, Rory Little, is there a strong case that Bill Barr committed perjury?
You know, is there a strong case? The second exchange certainly sounds like you could make the argument that he just flat out did not tell the truth about this. We now know this letter from Bob Mueller that came to him and then the subsequent conversation. You might want to ask more questions about that before you did it. But you have to jump ahead. If it was a crime, what are the remedies?
Yes.
You have a Trump-controlled Department of Justice now. You have an attorney general. This is the sort of case where normally you would appoint another special prosecutor to investigate the attorney general. The other alternative for Congress is to say, we do believe there was a crime, and we hereby begin impeachment proceedings for that attorney general. That is their other remedy. There really aren't other remedies. They're not going to refer this to the U.S. Attorney's Office because the U.S. Attorney's Office isn't going to do it, presumably. I think they're feeling their way along step by step to see how this develops before we can go beyond, you know, the general feeling that the attorney general was not candid with the committee.
So, yes, you point out that it would be, I mean, for lack of a better word, extremely awkward for a member of the Department of Justice to then go ahead and charge the attorney general. But at the same time, are you hesitating to give your legal opinion on whether or not this is an act of perjury?
Well, an act of perjury requires all kinds of construction of language. Frankly, it's a semantic idea. Hmm. Normally, we don't charge perjury until we have absolutely diametrically opposed conflicting evidence. You know, you've got to go to a criminal law jury, unanimous beyond a reasonable doubt. But boy, it sure sounds like the beginning of that kind of case. Absolutely.
And so impeachment would not require specifically a crime per se.
No, it doesn't. They can impeach. Gerald Ford is famous for saying for anything that they consider to be impeachable.
And also in terms of you're hearing a lot of lawmakers now taking that route and also presidential candidates saying that William Barr should be impeached. Andrew Desiderio of Politico, can you talk about what an impeachment proceeding would do politically for the Democrats, why this is a strategy they seem to be starting to coalesce around?
Right. So impeachment against the president would be, of course, different than impeachment against the attorney general. Both of those are extremely unlikely, if not impossible at this point, to be successful. The big question that Nancy Pelosi has been grappling with among House Democrats right now is this question of whether an impeachment inquiry, if they were to formally launch one, would actually embolden the president, especially if you do it so close to the 2020 presidential election. And it could really play into this whole argument that the president's been making that essentially these investigations, these oversight attempts by House Democrats are only meant for one purpose, and it's to bring me down as president. And I think that's something that Speaker Pelosi is very much worried about. And she's tried to channel that in a way in which she's not outwardly saying it would be politically disastrous for Democrats, even though that is the political reality that almost all Democrats realize at this point. But as you mentioned, there is almost a groundswell among the rank and file within the House Democratic Caucus that's moving closer and closer toward this idea of wanting to launch impeachment proceedings, especially as the president continues to fight strenuously against all of their oversight attempts and all of these subpoenas. We know, of course, the president has actually filed two lawsuits to challenge congressional subpoenas to obtain many of his financial records from accounting firms, from big banks such as Capital One and Deutsche Bank. So that idea has led many Democrats to not only accuse the president of obstructing their own investigations, but to say, look, it's time to start impeachment proceedings against the president.
We're talking about the escalating tensions between House Democrats and the Attorney General William Barr, what it all means, how it could play out, with Rory Little, professor of law at UC Hastings College of the Law, and Andrew Desiderio, a congressional reporter for Politico. And I'd like to invite you, our listeners, to join the conversation. What are your thoughts, questions, concerns about what's happening right now? Give us a call at 866-733-6786. 866-733-6786. You can post your comments on our website, kqed.org/forum. On Facebook, you can tweet us at KQED Forum or email us at forum@kqed.org. Rory Little, we heard Andrew Desiderio talking about Trump's unwillingness to comply with any subpoenas and also encouraging others not to comply. We also heard about a White House letter to the Attorney General basically saying that the president has a right to tell people not to testify before House Democrats. Is that correct? Are they right that he has full executive privilege to do that?
Well, I don't think it's right. I mean, we do have historical examples. When these tensions get so high between two independent branches under the Constitution, you generally end up with a case in the Supreme Court. So President Nixon refused to give over tapes. That went on an emergency basis to the Supreme Court, and a Republican-appointed Chief Justice ruled against him unanimously. You've got to do this. You've got to comply. So the idea that the executive branch has absolute immunity or authority is just not correct. It is not a simple thing, though, to go forward. I think what Andrew was referring to is that you can't win a conviction in the Senate, but you can certainly win an impeachment in the House. And now we have to cross the line from legal to political. Everybody has their view on the second, on the coming election. That's really the primary consideration, I think, in everybody's mind, the president's mind, the Democrats' mind. And nobody's quite sure how this plays out with middle America. How does this play out with the voters who will make the difference in 2020? And I think Nancy Pelosi is trying to be very careful before she commits to a strategy. But Congress does not take well to people refusing subpoenas. In the 1920s, the House arrested the brother of the attorney general because he refused to comply with the subpoena. It didn't go a lot further than that. It was the Teapot Dome scandal.
The Teapot Dome scandal,
but these
yes.
things happen.
Well, talk about what contempt of Congress really is and the weight of that, because there seems to be this distinction that the White House wants to make between contempt of Congress and contempt of court, for example.
Well, I mean, contempt is actually not perfectly well defined, but it is the refusal to comply with a valid congressional subpoena is pretty well accepted. Supreme Court precedent says that can be contempt. No difference between the branches. I mean, contempt of court is the same.
So how is a contempt of Congress finding enforced? You mentioned the arrest of the brother of the attorney general back in the 1820s or so, or in the 1920s, I'm sorry. But I imagine that's probably an unlikely course of action for this particular
People
Congress.
Think it's unlikely. I mean, let's be clear. There's a political dimension to all of this. So Eric Holder, the attorney general under President Obama, was held in contempt by a congressional committee. Nothing further ever happened with regard to that.
They negotiated the Fast and Furious.
Yeah, and they negotiated some document exchanges after that and all that. And for the next 2 years, the Republicans went around and said, well, Eric Holder has been held in contempt. Didn't change anything.
Well, let's go to some of our listeners, and I'm going to start with Jenny in Santa Monica. Hi, Jenny.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to ask, the Republicans are clearly not going to comply with any of the congressional requests or investigations, and they're breaking all the norms and not following the rules. So my question is, why are Democrats waiting for them to not comply? Why aren't they just having these subpoenas ready, or even starting with a subpoena instead of a request? Is there a reason why they're not doing that? Because it's pretty clear they're not going to comply.
Andrew Desiderio, I'll start with you on that, because it's a political question in a lot of ways.
Right. That's exactly right. So it's a very good question to ask, and it's something folks on the left have been pushing Democrats to do. But what Chairman Jerry Nadler of the Judiciary Committee has been arguing is that they want to show that they are engaged in good faith negotiations and that they are exhausting every single avenue possible before moving to a subpoena. That's how you show a court, if it gets to that point, that's how you show the court that essentially you've exhausted every avenue possible, and it makes it more likely for you to sort of make the case to the court that your subpoena and that your request is valid. So I understand the concerns that many folks have about the speed at which these and the pace at which these investigations are going. But Democrats are trying to be very deliberate, and it's for a reason.
Well, Representative Nadler sent a letter to Attorney General Barr today giving the Justice Department until Monday to respond, saying that the committee would move forward with contempt proceedings if it could not reach an agreement with the department with regard to the subpoena for the unredacted Mueller report. Do you have any sense, quickly, Andrew Desiderio, of where those negotiations stand? Is there any meaningful effort being made right now by the Justice Department?
I think it's unlikely, because 2 days ago, when the Justice Department officially said that they will not comply with the subpoena, they sent this 5 or 6 page letter, which essentially not only slammed Chairman Nadler and House Democrats for what they're trying to do, but laid out what they believe is their legal argument that prevents them from turning over all this information, including the grand jury information, most notably. So it doesn't seem like the Justice Department is going to engage on what Jerry Nadler is now calling his counteroffer. But again, this is another way that Nadler is essentially trying to just give not just make an ultimatum to the Justice Department, but to give them every opportunity to comply voluntarily before moving with their moving forward with their next step.
And apropos of Jenny's statement about Republicans not following any rules or norms, I just want to play a cut from Jerry Nadler about what he views is at stake with the AG refusing to appear before the committee, comply with subpoenas.
He is trying to render Congress inert as a separate and co-equal branch of government. The challenge we face is that if we don't stand up to him together today, we risk forever losing the power to stand up to any president in the future.
Rory Little, do you agree?
Well, here's what I'll agree with. Andrew is exactly right that you've got to give them every chance to negotiate this. The Nixon tapes case, which went to the Supreme Court, was months, actually, in the making of process and process and process. By the time it got to the Supreme Court, there was no question that he'd been given every opportunity to negotiate it and had refused. And it is at that point that they said, you can enforce a congressional subpoena. And then the president did turn over the tapes. Now, is this tape thing worth it? Is the unredacted Mueller report really worth that effort? I don't know. I do think White House staffers take this very seriously. I don't think they're just going to dig their heels in, but their president seems to be directing them to do that.
Well, let's go next to Becky in Oakland. Hi, Becky.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'd like to go back to the issue of Attorney General Barr and the question of perjury. I can't help but be reminded of President Bill Clinton, who was, of course, impeached on a charge of perjury, and it came down to sort of definitions of what is sex and how we're parsing questions. And I'm wondering if you all think there's any lessons to be learned by that most recent impeachment and sort of in deciding where we go with Attorney General Barr.
Roy Little.
Well, it's hard to know what the lessons are. I mean, one thing we know is that perjury is a ground for impeachment. We know that, and that's what happened. We also know the Senate did not convict. We also seem to recall that the Democrats did pretty well in the midterms, but then they didn't do so well in the next election, although that's debatable too, right? The Supreme Court decided that election. I think there's always room for semantic argument, and I don't think we have enough yet. This is one instance, I think, of Bill Barr saying something directly contrary. I would not indict that case for perjury without some further investigation.
Well, thanks, Becky, for that point. And Kurt writes, I understand Barr didn't show at the House Judiciary Committee hearing Thursday because the questioning will be done by congressional staff people rather than the members of Congress themselves. Is this true? If it is true, then I don't blame Barr. Kurt's right to the extent that they wanted to have their staff attorneys committee counsel also question Barr as well. And we've heard from members of the Judiciary Committee that this is not unprecedented. So how common is it for committee attorneys, for staff attorneys to question witnesses?
Well, we could remember pretty recently that when the Kavanaugh thing was happening, the Republicans actually brought in an independent female prosecutor from another state to do that examination for them. They wanted a real lawyer to do it. That's what the Democrats are saying here. It's actually pretty clear that Congress can decide how it wants to investigate. They are a co-equal branch. The president can decide how he wants to cooperate. And then there can be a conflict, and you have to go to court to enforce that.
Well, Republicans have also made the case that the committee's demands for the full unredacted report, that it doesn't serve a legislative purpose, and that's required. Can you talk about whether or not, well, what that is and whether you agree with it?
It's simply not true that it doesn't serve a legislative purpose. If the purpose is to investigate, for example, an impeachable offense, Ken Starr turned over the entire unredacted Clinton report with grand jury material, didn't even ask any questions. Same is true way back in the Nixon era. Congress has the right to see things. And how that plays out, really, it's unfortunate that it ends up in court, and it's also unfortunate it takes a long time, and the American people are usually more impatient.
Rory Little is a professor of constitutional law and a former federal prosecutor. He's at UC Hastings College of the Law. We also have Politico's Andrew Desiderio with us, and now we have Janet from Corte Madera. Hi, Janet.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question.
Sure.
I am wondering about the subpoena for the unredacted report, and specifically the information in there about the, I believe it's 12 additional cases that Mueller referred to other districts. We don't know what those cases are. Who knows right now what those cases are? And specifically to the point that Bill Barr said yesterday he would not recuse himself from those cases, and he also did not evaded the answer about whether or not he has spoken to the president or anyone in the executive branch about any cases. So I'm just wondering if that question to get access to that unredacted report relates to that information.
Hmm. Well, it's unclear what those 12 cases are or even who they are about, Rory Little, but do you see a connection here?
Well, I'm not sure that's what Congress really wants to do. I don't think anyone wants to interfere with ongoing investigations. They can always receive things in camera or under seal. Hopefully, they would take seriously the idea that you shouldn't interfere with an ongoing case. Who knows about this? The Attorney General knows about this. Honestly, if he were to recuse, then the Deputy Attorney General becomes the acting AG. That's going to change in about less than 2 weeks. Rod Rosenstein's going to leave. A new person, hopefully, is going to be confirmed pretty quickly. So it becomes a mix of politics and law. They have in the past, the Department of Justice has in the past, contacted an outside U.S. attorney, say from Chicago, to come in and do a special investigation. Right now, I think the level of mistrust between the branches and between the American people and the president right now is pretty high. And so I'm not sure that would work either.
Well, Skip writes, Pelosi accused Barr of lying to Congress in his testimony Wednesday. What was the lie that he said? I mean, I think this is sort of that hard question, right? Clearly, she's referring to him not disclosing his knowledge of Robert Mueller's unhappiness with his summary of his 448-page report.
Yeah, I think the question was something like, do you know what Bob Mueller thinks? And he said no.
Or not he agreed with your conclusions on obstruction of justice.
Yeah, I guess Barr could argue, well, I actually don't know what he thinks. I'm not a mind reader, blah, blah, blah. You can always wiggle around on this stuff. But the idea that he didn't then say, I did receive a letter from Bob Mueller that expressed some displeasure, at least with the context, et cetera, was a lack of candor. If I were Congress, I would be very upset about that. If I were a prosecutor, would I indict that for a unanimous beyond a reasonable doubt? I think it's tough to do that. But that's the lie. That's the one sort of, I think, very diametrically opposed question and answer.
Is misleading an impeachable offense?
You know, the famous statement is Congress can impeach for anything that they think is impeachable. No one knows. The Constitution says high crimes and misdemeanors. That's been construed to include obstruction of justice and perjury.
Can I just ask you, as somebody who has studied the Mueller report very deeply, you brought it with you. I mean, it's in terms just your reaction to Barr's testimony on Wednesday about the Mueller report, where he poked a lot of holes, actually, in Mueller's legal analysis.
Well, I don't think Bob Mueller and Bill Barr are going to be good friends in the future, even if they have been in the past. I think the Attorney General was less than candid in certain regards, and I think his legal conclusions are flatly wrong. And Bob Mueller, in his report, takes on the legal theory that the president can't obstruct justice if he's acting pursuant to his executive branch powers. That's just not right. And people are prosecuted for obstruction of justice all the time for doing things that are otherwise legal, but they do it with a corrupt intent. So the question of corrupt intent is the centerpiece here. And Bob Mueller did not exonerate the president. He said, we don't think we can answer that question because he can't be impeached under the Department of Justice rules. Should Bill Barr have answered that question? I think his answer may be no less or more valid than the answer of members of Congress.
Bill writes, if the Democrats want to find out what Mueller thinks about Barr, maybe they should be subpoenaing Mueller. Will Mueller testify, Andrew Desiderio? We've been hearing about this May 15th date that's being dangled, and we've heard that William Barr has no problems with Mueller testifying, but do we know if that's going to happen?
Right. We don't know if it's going to happen. That's the short answer. But Chairman Nadler seemed pretty optimistic about May 15th when I was asking him about it the other day. I reported earlier this week that the Justice Department and Mueller's team are right now engaging directly with the House Judiciary Committee to talk about sort of the terms of Mueller's testimony, the idea of setting a date, a time, things like that, the basic logistics of it, in addition to the substance. I think it's likely that Mueller will testify. I think, you saw, of course, the letter he wrote to Bill Barr in which he expressed objections with the way he summarized the report. I think Mueller I think that letter showed that Mueller is eager to talk. The extent to which he reveals more substantive information beyond what's in his report, I'm not sure about that. But I think he definitely wants to talk, especially to give his side of the coin right after the Attorney General, as you said, poked holes in many of Mueller's legal theories and his legal framework as outlined in the report.
Well, Roy Little, what do you think Congress should try to gain from a Mueller testimony? And I'm talking about both Republicans and Democrats.
Well, let me just say a couple things. First, I know Bob Mueller. He is not eager to talk. He is never eager to talk. He does not talk. He is not eager to talk here. The second thing is the Democrats have to be very careful because they might not get what they're looking for. Bob Mueller is going to come in and say, I am a lawyer. There is a privilege between what I do and my client. I'm not quite sure who my client here is, but it's probably the Department of Justice, and I have to preserve privilege matters. So I would be very careful. Barr said he had no problem with Mueller personally testifying. That doesn't mean he's going to let him testify professionally.
Do you think Mueller should testify, Roy Little?
He will testify if he's subpoenaed.
But do you think he should?
If I were a Democrat, I'd be very careful.
Roy Little of UC Hastings
Democrat,
College of Law and Andrew Desiderio of Politico. Thanks to both of you for talking with us this morning.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
And thanks to our listeners for your questions and comments. Stay with us for another hour forum, this time on cell phone bans with high school students. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.